Hey Seth, if you're able to, can you get the meeting started? I'm still about 5 minutes out.
You guys hear us online?
Yeah, well, I can hear everyone.
Okay, we just got it started, so we're going through introductions.
Awesome. Thank you.
Is it my mic?
There you go. I can hear
That's
that.
better.
Yep.
I had a bad mic. Okay, introductions, Eric Nolimo, SJ Engineering.
Dan Weisner, Songbird Homes.
Houston Aho, Aho Construction.
Seth Hauling with AKS Engineering.
Andrew Gunther, PLS Engineering.
Victoria Abram, Community Development.
Okay, also a reminder, the DEEB meetings will be recorded and the audio will be posted on the DEEB's website. The next item is to review and adopt minutes. Did everyone have a chance to review the minutes? Oh, sorry. Let's do introductions online. Sorry. I'm jumping right to it.
Jamie Housley, Jordan Ramos.
Mike Odrin, McKay Esposito.
Mary Jones, Southwest Washington Contractors Association.
Hi, Devin Rostifer, Clean Water Division.
I'm Les McDonald. I'm the Planning and Development Program Manager for Clark Regional Wastewater District. I'm glad to be here, my first meeting.
Diana Nett, Development Engineering.
Anyone else online?
Krista Kobleski with OTAC.
Eric, I know that Terry won't be able to make it today.
Yep. Okay. See, is Oliver on there to hear to introduce himself? I'm not sure who else. I can't quite see everyone. But if anyone else online wants to introduce themselves.
Yes, I'm trying to unmute myself. This is Oliver, OGF Community Planning.
Okay, and we've got a few people in the audience.
Brent Davis, Community Development.
Jenna Kay, Community Planning.
Ian Harkins, BIA.
Okay, we already went over the recording. The next item is to review and adopt minutes. Has anyone had a chance to review the minutes?
I have one request, if I could. My name is spelled MACDONALD. That's typo in there.
Any other comments?
Is it call to order time correct at 2:30 or was it 2 o'clock last meeting?
2 o'clock. Okay. Anything else? So do I have a motion to approve the revised minutes with the correction of the spelling and the call to order at 2 o'clock?
I'll motion to approve.
Second.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
I think that was an aye. Not an, minutes are approved. Review upcoming events.
All right. For the month of June, on June 3rd, which already happened, they had a county council meeting for the road vacation Northeast 119th Street, along with a 2025 amended annual construction program. The county council also had a work session on June 4th for the Clean Water Commission 2024 annual report and the 2025 work plan. For the planning commission work sessions and hearings, tonight, June 5th, the Planning Commission work session for the comp plan policy, which covers the climate element, rural and natural resource element, and parks, recreation, open space elements with climate integration. That's all we have on the schedule.
Thank you. Any member announcements? None from anyone else. I did get an email, and a few of us, I think, did, from Jamie Clark about an interpretation on the compact lot and narrow lot standards and how they interact. And there was some discussion that went back and forth on email. It might be something we want to mention in our next meeting, if it's something important. It might just be something that's quickly resolved, but there was kind of a question. It was clear, I think, during the HOSAP committee that if you have narrow lots and you're doing a compact lot, then the narrow lot standards also apply. However, the narrow lot standards themselves have criteria. For example, when you look at parking, like offsite parking, that you need to provide 1.5 stalls or one stall for every 3 homes under 40 feet wide. So it's not for total lots. And it was kind of an interpretation of how that's applied. And there was already something that kind of went out between him and a few D members. And what we can do is we can maybe put that on the agenda for next month, if it's something you guys feel is important. And it might get canceled out if staff has a different response to it. But
yeah, I would move that we put it on next month's agenda. I think it's an important thing as it's a new code.
Okay.
And prior to the next meeting, I can provide staff's correspondence with Mr. Clark on that question.
Sounds good. Any other member announcements? With that, I'm going to turn it over to Mike.
Eric, can I say something really quick?
Yes.
If you have not seen my emails, my last day with the county is tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
Yeah, I've known for a little bit, but I will be the new administrator for Parks and Outdoor for Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Whoa.
So my replacement will be Maya Bunch. She will be the interim director for community development for Clark County.
Well, thank you for your service here.
Yeah,
appreciate it. Sorry for my late arrival. There was traffic and, things just didn't go my way today. So, Eric, thank you for taking over for me while I was delayed. Where have we made it through? Member announcements?
Two.
Yep. Awesome. Okay. Stormwater code and manual proposed updates. Trista, I presume you're online there. There you go. The floor is yours.
Thank you. And Devin Rostrofer from Clean Water is also here. Devin, do you want to say anything before I launch in?
No, I would say go ahead and hop right in.
Okay. I will share my screen. Okay, so we've got 20 minutes today, and you've heard a lot of this presentation before. So this is our last chance to talk to Deeb before we submit the Stormwater Code and Manual changes to Department of Ecology. So we wanted to take this, one last chance to present to you what we're planning to show Department of Ecology. So as a reminder, here's our agenda. So we will present these new set of changes that you haven't seen before. We will have a quick reminder of an earlier set of changes that we presented to you in fall of 2024 that you've already seen. And if we have time, we'll follow up on some discussion from the last time we spoke to you folks, and then we'll talk about our next steps. So project overview, just as a reminder. Oh, folks are saying they can't see my screen. Can other people not see the screen?
We can see it here in the room.
I can see it now. My apologies.
Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. Great. So as a reminder of the project overview, what the county is doing is complying with the Department of Ecology's Phase 1 municipal stormwater permit that it issues to the county every 5 years or so. And each time that permit is issued, they generally ask the county to update its requirements for stormwater control on new development and redevelopment sites. And so we are reviewing Appendix 1. We are reviewing the updated Stormwater Management Manual for Western Washington for changes to that. We are reviewing Permit Appendix 10 to find all the changes that Ecology is either suggesting or requiring. And we are incorporating those into the Clark County Code 13.26A for water quality, Title 4100 for definitions, Title 40.386 for stormwater and erosion control, a few changes in 40.500 for procedures, and of course the Clark County Stormwater Manual itself, and changes to that manual are mostly focused in Books 1 and Books 2. Book 1 is sort of thresholds and applicability of the minimum requirements for stormwater control, and Book 2 is more of the design requirements and technical requirements. There are also a couple changes in Book 3 for source control and Book 4 for maintenance. This is the schedule of the project that we've embarked on, and we started in 2024, early in the year. We've been collecting through that year, looking at not only Ecology's required changes, but seeing this as an opportunity to pull the community, such as yourselves, and find out what other changes were desired in the Clark County Manual and the stormwater control ordinances. So we've done that. We've collected all those requests for changes, itemized everything, kind of put them in categories as to what is truly mandated by Ecology, what is significant enough that Ecology needs to review. And we're here now in this project timeline in which we're about to submit the set of changes that Ecology needs to review. And we will have about 180 days to continue working on some of the other changes that they're not going to review, because they have a 180-day period to review those that we've submitted to them. So during that time, we'll continue to work on proposed language changes, and we will also conduct our training needs assessment. So Ecology should then finish their review in winter, December or so, and then we will have through the rest of the winter and into the summer of 2026 to refine any changes, present strikeout and underline drafts of the manual, present the information to the Planning Commission and the County Council, and adopt and enforce by July 1, 2026. That is our permit deadline that we are striving for. And then after that, we'll probably do some training in the summer and fall of 2026. Excuse me. So this is the heart of what we want to talk about today. This is what we are going to submit to Ecology at the end of June here. And we have culled these 10 items that you'll see in a moment from a list of over 100 requests for changes that we received from the community and county staff. And those 10 are ones that we have deemed significant, and I put that in quotes, but Ecology asks to review only significant changes. So we're not submitting all 100 language changes to Ecology, we're submitting about 10 of those that have originated from staff in the community. And I didn't put it on the slide, but I will define for you what how we define significant. If the change made a change to the text of a threshold or a minimum requirement, or how to document feasibility of a low impact development best management practice, it was considered significant. If the change prohibited the use of a facility type, we were going to consider it significant. Or if it made a change to the ACART standard, which is a requirement of the permit. ACART stands for All Known, Available, and Reasonable Methods of Prevention, Control, and Treatment. to prevent and control pollution to waters of Washington State. So it's just a term that is in the permit that is quite significant. So those 10 items are what met that threshold for us. So we will take a few minutes to review what those are, and they were posted online in advance. So hopefully you've had a chance to print them out or look at them in advance. Because it's going to be a little bit hard to see on the screen. And also, for whatever reason, I can't find it on my screen right now, although I know I have it open. Bear with me. Okay, here we go. Sorry about that. Did folks get a chance to look at this in advance or print them out so that these are legible? I'm not hearing anyone, so.
We have them printed out in the room.
Okay, fantastic. Okay, so these 10 changes are the ones we're going to go through today. We have about 13 minutes left until the next agenda item. So we'll try to move through these relatively quickly. We'll just start at the top. So in Book 1, Section 2.3.2, this is a change to the depth of soils log for demonstrating the feasibility of downspout full infiltration. So it is particular to downspout full infiltration to meet minimum requirement 5, or changing the soils log depth from minimum of 4 feet to 10 feet. And this is to ensure that when applicants are evaluating feasibility of downspout full infiltration, they are able to evaluate the feasibility of both an infiltration trench, which is a horizontal UIC, as well as a dry well. Dry wells being deeper, they can extend further into the soil. Secondly, on a similar vein, but for best management practices of fire retention, rain gardens, or permeable pavement, we are adding the word depth to Book 1, Section 2.3.4, which is a requirement to test infiltration rate at the location where the site is proposing to use fire retention, rain gardens, or permeable pavement. Just adding the word depth to ensure that it's known that you need not only a horizontal spread of test locations, but also to test at the appropriate depths. It's not a technical change, it's more of a clarification of how to characterize the soils when you're proposing infiltration. The third item is in Book 1, Section 4.2, Step A, which is the itemized description of how to choose a flow control best management practice. And this statement clarifies the county's existing policy. It does not change it. It just makes it more clear that infiltration is the county's preferred method for meeting minimum requirement 7 flow control, and that infiltration should be evaluated first before moving on to other options for providing a flow control facility. Again, this doesn't change the county's policy. That is the current policy. It simply clarifies it in that location where applicants are moving through that stepwise process. The next one and the last one on this page is in Book 1, Section 4.3.1.1, in which the regulatory requirements for underground injection controls are repeated from the state's UIC program or the manual. Because the Clark County Stormwater Manual contains both stormwater management for surface waters and design requirements for UICs in part, we wanted to add Clark County is planning to prohibit the use of deep UIC wells. Those are a new technology that can extend 100 feet or more into the ground. They are different from your typical drywall or infiltration trench. And because the county is underlain by the Troutdale Aquifer, which is a federally designated sole source aquifer and is the source of drinking water for the county, we're planning to prohibit the use of deep UIC wells. And the next one is that same prohibition repeated in Book 2, Section 5.2, which is where dry well design criteria are given in the Clark County Stormwater Manual.
Is there a definition on what's deep infiltration? Because I could see that being like, you know, 13, 14, even 16, 18 feet is pretty typical. What makes it deep?
That is not a deep dry well. The deep dry wells will punch through a impermeable layer and then go deeper into a permeable layer that is below it. I do not have the exact definition. I could look that up in the UIC program rules or the Western Washington Manual. But what you just described would not be considered a deep drywall.
Yeah, there are situations though where the topsoil is impermeable and then there's decent soil below. So you typically do punch through the first layer and you hit the next layer down. So yeah, I think you're talking more like static groundwater, that the same aquifer you'd put like residential, like regional wells into. So yeah, I just worry about unintended consequences of some of these definitions, and we end up with these code interpretations that seem like they were well defined, but there could be a conflict later. So just want to make sure we don't cause anything like that.
Okay, I can look up the exact definition of that in the UIC program, and get back to you. All right, the next one we're looking at here is in Book 1, Section 2.5.3.3, which is the feasibility and setback requirements for the use of full dispersion, not just any dispersion, just full dispersion, which is when you are using dispersion as the only BMP on a lot, generally in residential areas, residential development in the rural area of Clark County. There was a county management practice that was adopted when the 2015 manual was adopted that provided some clarification on how the feasibility or infeasibility criteria should be compared to setbacks in critical areas. The critical area code has been updated since then a few times. That management practice is out of date. And what we're proposing now is just for any of those setbacks or prohibitions for use of dispersion BMPs within a critical area, they're now just being incorporated into the Clark County manual text itself. It's a little bit too much to go over in this table. So there is a separate handout that looks like this. Sorry, that was right in the middle of it. But it's an issue discussion paper, and it has the full strikeout and underline of what we're proposing to change. These really just ensure that full dispersion is in alignment with the county's critical area code. In some respects, it provides more flexibility for the use of full dispersion. And then in other respects, it makes sure to hopefully avoid some of the risks of dispersion in geologically hazardous areas, steep slopes, erosion hazards, et cetera. So we're trying to provide more flexibility, protect critical areas that need to be protected, and just be consistent with the county's critical area code. So feel free to look over that separately and offline if you wish. These actually two rows are both talking about that. So some of that language is going to change in book one, and some of that language is going to change in book two, where we have the design requirements for BMP T530A full dispersion.
It's a good change.
Yeah, that it should clarify things, hopefully. Fewer cross-references, the better, right? Okay, and speaking of fewer cross-references, these next two are sort of along those lines as well. In the 2021 and dating back, I think, to the 2015 Clark County Stormwater Manual, in the thresholds for complying with minimum requirements, we, instead of using this full term, native vegetation, pasture, scrub, shrub, or unmaintained non-native vegetation, and the act of converting any of those to a lawn or landscaped area, or converting native vegetation to pasture, the theory was we would skip all that repetitive language and use the term converted vegetation in our thresholds in the Clark County Stormwater Manual. But actually, the Western Washington Manual and the permit itself uses this whole phrase repeatedly. And so because the Clark County Stormwater Manual was using just the phrase converted vegetation, it was causing readers, users of the manual, some confusion. So what we have decided to do is just revert to the actual language that's in the Western Washington Manual and write out that full phrase when we're talking about the thresholds for applying the minimum requirements. So you can see here, we're adding back in the word native vegetation. We're adding this detail about converting pasture, scrub and shrub, or unmaintained non-native vegetation to lawn or landscaped areas. So it just clarifies that. So that will be clarified both in the thresholds for new development where that term appeared, and here, similarly, in the threshold discharge area thresholds for minimum requirement number 7 flow control. So those clarifications, again, they do not change policy or change any of these thresholds. Hopefully, they just provide a clearer user experience, both for developers and the staff who are regulating. And then similarly, the redevelopment thresholds, we're using the phrase converted pervious area. That term is not defined in the Clark County Stormwater Manual, and it is not used in the Western Washington Manual or in the permit. So we are proposing to change that back to converted vegetation areas. And that is the extent of the what we have deemed significant changes that we are presenting to Department of Ecology at the end of June. For the ones that were not organized by Department of Ecology itself. And I will flip back momentarily to the presentation. And I only have 1 minute left, so I won't spend very much time on this. But there are another set of changes that Deeb was shown way back in the fall, I believe it was November of 2024, a long table that incorporated changes related to these 7 items that Ecology has called out as their significant mandated changes. So you had a chance to look at these before in detail. Again, that was a long list related to these 7 items. We've got changes in books 1, book 2, title 40 related to these particular changes. And we didn't make any edits to what we're planning to submit to Ecology since we showed these to you last November. So those remain the same. We have little flexibility on these as they're mandated by Ecology. So we're pretty much taking those verbatim from what's in Appendix 1 and Appendix 10 of the permit. And I'm a little bit over time, so I will wrap it up there. But those two tables are what we're planning to submit to Ecology at the end of June. We wanted to just, again, take this last time to talk to Deeb about that and give you a chance to look through what's going to Ecology, and then let you know that, again, Ecology is going to have 180 days. While they're doing that, we're going to continue to work through some of those other changes, some of which you've heard about before, such as the geotechnical investigation requirements that Haley and Aldridge presented a few months ago, and any of those other from that list of 100 requested changes that we collected over the several months in 2024. We'll be working through those. And so the next steps for Deeb is that after Ecology does their review and we make any updates thanks to that, we'll be presenting all the proposed updates to the Stormwater Code and Manual in strikeout and underline form or table form, essentially next winter, at the end of 2025 or early 2026. And we will come back to Deeb at that time and make sure you have a chance to review the full suite of changes, even after Ecology has had a chance to look at what we're submitting. That's my presentation for today.
Great. Thank you, Trista. Does anybody have any other quick questions for her? Seeing none, appreciate it. We'll see you again, yeah. I'm sure, in the not too distant future.
Yep. Thanks, everyone.
Yep. Appreciate it. All right, moving on. The climate element action update, which we have all been looking so forward to reviewing. Jenna, floor is yours.
Thanks for having me. Can you all hear me okay?
We can in the room. Can everybody hear her okay online? Let us know if you can't.
Okay, wonderful. Well, for those of you who I don't know, my name is Jenna Kay. I am a land use planner in the community planning department, and I've been serving as the project manager on the county's climate project that I'm here to talk to you all about today, in which we are working on implementing some new state climate change planning legislation here in Clark County. My colleague, Harrison Husting, is online to help me field questions from you all. He's a transportation planner in our department, who's been working with me on this project. And I apologize, this is such a long agenda item for you all. There's just a lot of background I feel like I need to catch you all up on. And then whatever time we have, we can talk about proposed policies. And if you need me to come back later, I'm happy to do that too. So with that, my plan is to provide project background, what this is, where it came from, share some key definitions and research findings that are sort of underlying what's being proposed, talk about what's in the proposal, make sure I talk about where we are in the process and what's next, and then I'll leave as much time as I can for questions. We can go to the next slide. All right, and I'm going to start with the project background. We can go to the next one. So House Bill 1181, or HB 1181, was signed into law in 2023. This legislation added a new climate change and resiliency goal into the state's Growth Management Act. So the Growth Management Act now has 15 goals, and it didn't used to. So that's a significant change to that law. And with the addition of this new goal, the law now requires that Clark County add a climate element, you can think of an element as a chapter, in its comprehensive plan. And this comprehensive plan has to address two things. It needs to address resilience, as well as greenhouse gas emissions reduction. There's some other themes in this legislation if you read it. It's pretty long, it's about 50 pages, but you're welcome to read it. Some of the other themes in it are we need to include environmental justice and make sure we are developing policies that benefit people who are most vulnerable in our community to the impacts from climate change. There are requirements around use of best available science in our work. And the legislation also requires that Washington State Department of Commerce provide guidance for local jurisdictions to implement this law. And those of us working for local jurisdictions, our work has to be consistent with that guidance.
Jenna?
There's a mandatory due date. Oh, yes.
Real quick, resilience. Can you expand on that a little bit? I mean, resilience to...
I will in just a moment.
Oh, perfect.
Okay.
Yeah, Jenna? Jenna?
Yeah.
If I may, the presentation's not being shown online. Does not appear.
Oh. We are going to fix that. Sorry about that. Okay, can you see it now?
Yes, thank you.
Yes.
Okay, I apologize. I think this is the only slide of substance so far, so you haven't missed anything. okay, so there's a mandatory due date written into the law, so the county has to adopt a new climate element by December 31st, 2025, as part of our comprehensive plan update. So this is like a project within that big project. It's a piece of it. The law is getting implemented in waves, so every county and city in the state is assigned a due date, and we are in the first wave. So that means nobody in the state has implemented this yet. There's plenty of communities who've done climate planning before, but they didn't do it under the framework of this law. So this is brand new, and we get to be in the, you know, guinea pig first wave. All right, let's go to the next slide. Okay, so the resilience sub-element or portion of this work, the core requirements of what we need to do for that is the county needs to identify goals, policy, programs, or actions that the county is going to take over the next 20 years to identify, protect, and enhance natural areas to climate impacts, identify, protect, and enhance community resiliency, including social, economic, and built environment factors consistent with environmental justice. We need to make sure we are addressing natural hazards that are created or aggravated by climate change. And the sub-element requires prioritizing actions that benefit overburdened communities that will disproportionately suffer from the compounding environmental impacts and natural hazards due to climate change. And then for the greenhouse gas reduction sub-element, the legislation requires the county to identify actions it will take over the next 20 years to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and vehicle miles traveled per person without increasing greenhouse gas emissions elsewhere in the state. So we cannot shift our emissions to our neighbors, essentially. And these actions also need to prioritize reductions that benefit overburdened communities to maximize the co-benefits of reduced air pollution and environmental justice. So if you find a section of the growth management, these are sort of the key bullet points in this new climate element that we need to meet. So if we go to the next slide, this is a high-level overview of our project timeline, and we have five key phases of work, and we are at the STAR right now. But we started with exploring climate impacts. I'm going to show you I'll show you the key findings out of each of these phases. And that led us to development of a draft resilience policy list. We did a greenhouse gas inventory, which then led us to developing a draft of greenhouse gas reduction policy list. We then spent many months reviewing and refining those policy ideas. We now have a draft set of climate element policies that we are getting ready to bring into the adoption process. But because this is part of the whole comp plan update, adoption is actually many months away. So Planning Commission and Council won't be voting on this until either late this year or early next, because it's part of the entire comp plan update. So I'm going to introduce this to you today, but you have many months to look at these policies if you wish. Okay, a little bit more background and how we did this work. We've done quite a bit of community engagement. So we did, you know, out in the community engagement, and then also worked with three advisory groups. So I just want to tell you a little bit about them. I think you might know some people involved in some of these groups. So we had a community advisory group, or CAG for short. This was a group made up of 20 people who were appointed by the county manager and represented a really wide range of interests. I'm going to show you a list of who was in that group in a moment. You know, but this included folks in building and development to representing environmental interests and other community interests. And this group was charged with using a consensus-based process to recommend a list of goals and policies for the county to implement as part of this new legislation. We also worked with an Environmental Justice Coalition, or EJC for short, and this was a group of 15 community-based organizations. We contracted with them to help us with our community engagement so that when we went out to collect feedback, we were making sure we were hearing from our more underserved community members. And they also helped us review draft policies through an equity lens to help us with those equity requirements that we have in this legislation. And then we had a partner agency team, which was basically a technical review team of various county staff and our colleagues at the ports and the hospitals and school districts, fire districts, various county departments, and so forth. So lots of people have given us a lot of feedback along the way so far. So if we go to the next slide, I just wanted to show you who was in this community advisory group. And I'm just going to focus in on the jobs and growth sector, which I think overlaps the most with what you all do. So you can see who was involved. So representing in our business position was Janet Konefsky, Economic and Workforce Development. Nick Massey was in the group. Thilo Kluth represented freight. For home building, Andrea Smith and Justin Wood were in the group. Industry, both of our industry representatives happened to work in the energy sector. So we had Nelson Holmberg with Northwest Natural and Terry Tolan, who works with Clark PUD. And then Noelle Laverne was in our land development position. And then you can see all the other positions in the group as well. But just wanted to make sure you all knew who was involved if you didn't already. Encourage you to talk with them offline too to get their perspective.
I did notice Noel is here. I'm not sure if anyone else in this room was part of that group, but sort of.
Okay. And then I guess I would just note Councillor Michelle Belcott was the council liaison to the group, so she sat through many of the meetings as well and was listening in along the way. All right, let's go to the next slide. Okay, so that was the general background. Now I want to shift a little bit more and just share key definitions behind some of this work and sort of some of the key data sets that are basically underlying what came out of this. So if we go to the next slide, Mike, you had asked what I meant by resilience. Here's an actual definition written into state law. And so climate resilience means the ongoing process of anticipating, preparing for, and adapting to changes in climate and minimizing negative impacts to our natural systems, infrastructure, and communities. If we go to the next slide, I want to just focus in on what are we talking about when we say changes in climate? Like, what does that actually mean here in Clark County? So if we go to the next slide, we had to look at projections of what the climate is supposed to be like here in Clark County in the future. This is written into the Commerce guidance that we had to follow. We had to use certain resources. And if you look at a business as usual scenario, nothing changes in terms of emissions globally. What we expect to see here is more hot days in the summer, more likely summer drought, more high fire danger days, more days with smoky air, more extreme precipitation events, more frequent and severe flooding along certain streams and rivers, and more likely landslides in certain places in the county. So this is what we're talking about when we're talking about changes in climate that we need to plan for. Okay, next slide. So our task in needing to come up with things we're gonna do to improve resilience in the county is not actually, we're not planning. We can't change the hazards, right? We're not planning to change the weather here. Our job is to understand the implications of those projections and make sure we have plans and things we can do so that we're better prepared, you know, for the impacts of those hazards. So I have a link on this slide. You're welcome to look at it. It's a big table that looks at sort of key impacts across a lot of different sectors in the county. And I just pulled out an excerpt there at the bottom. So I'll just highlight a few examples of the types of things that we're trying to plan for. So related to, you know, buildings and energy, we are expecting that the demand for heating in winter is going to go down over time. And the demand for cooling in summer is going to go up over time because generally our winters are supposed to get more mild. Our summers are supposed to get hotter. And then, you know, related to zoning and development, A few examples there. You know, we are expecting to see more damage to property over time from things, whether it's wildfires or flooding, things like that. And we are expecting higher insurance costs in certain parts of the county as well. So these are the types of examples of things we are anticipating to see more of over the next couple of decades. Okay, next slide. Okay, so that was your primer on the resilience piece. I'm gonna go back to greenhouse gas emissions reduction. This is the definition the Department of Commerce has given to us for greenhouse gas emissions reduction, meaning actions taken to reduce or eliminate the emissions of greenhouse gases, present and future, in order to reduce the rate and extent of climate damage. So that is the definition we are working with. And if you go to the next slide, following the Commerce guidance, our kind of first step with planning for reducing greenhouse gas emissions was to understand what our emissions are. And so we had to do a emissions inventory, which it's really an accounting exercise to track the sources of emissions here in the county. It serves as a baseline for us to measure against in the future. And this slide shows the snapshot of the results from that inventory. It's based on 2022 data. And these are emissions that are locally produced. So this means emissions from things within the unincorporated county, plus any emissions tied to our electricity sources for the electricity used in the unincorporated county. So that's what these emissions are capturing. So if you look at the slide really quick, unincorporated county is in 2022 had about 1.5 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent is our total emissions. So everything gets converted into carbon dioxide, even though there's different kinds of greenhouse gases. That averages out to about 6 metric tons of carbon dioxide per person in the unincorporated county. And our largest sources of emissions come from the transportation sector and the building energy sector, followed by agriculture, forestry, and land use. And then we have small amounts related to industrial process and product use. That basically means refrigeration and refrigerants. And then a little bit from solid waste and wastewater. If you're wondering for some context, what do these numbers mean relative to other places or things like that? Those numbers, we are lower than the average emissions for the state of Washington, but higher than the emissions, you know, globally per person. Okay, so here are the results again in bar chart form. So those numbers I just showed are now on the left side of this screen. And I just want to show this because there are other types of greenhouse gas emissions, mostly from the things we buy. You know, so for instance, and these are called imported emissions. So this means there are emissions produced elsewhere in the world, even if we consume those goods here. So for instance, if we buy food from the grocery stores, it was grown in California, emissions tied with growing that food are local to California, but are count as imported emissions here because we eat the food here.
Clover is taller than I was thinking it would get, but
yeah, well, cut it.
Yeah.
We get everybody to mute themselves, please. Thank you. Not you, Jenna.
Thanks, Mike. So I wanted to share this because the right side of the screen is bigger than the emissions on the left side of the screen. However, we have a lot more control and influence over the emissions on the left side of the screen. And House Bill 1181 is really focused on those local emissions. So while there are plenty of things we can do to encourage, buying things with a lower carbon footprint, which would affect the stuff on the right, our main focus is this left side on how do we reduce emissions related to transportation here, the building energy used here, and so forth. And the last thing I want to say about emissions is we are supposed to be aligning with the statewide target of getting to net zero emissions by the year 2050. So that's like the overarching goal with reducing our emissions. And net zero meaning you can still have some emissions, but you need to figure out how you're going to compensate for that. Okay, next slide. So We have a full report on this emissions inventory. It's on our webpage. You're welcome to look at it. But just to highlight some of the key sources behind those rolled up numbers, this is showing our building energy emissions breakdown. I don't think any of this is surprising, but you know, the main sources of emissions related to building energy is our sources of electricity, followed by our use of natural gas. And the lighter blue is the urban area. Rural is the darker blue. And if you go to the next slide and look at transportation, our other sort of bigger source of emissions, urban areas on the left in this case, rural is on the right. And you can see that largest source of emissions for transportation is the gasoline we use in our vehicles. Again, I don't think that's very surprising. And then also the diesel we use for off-road and freight vehicles is next. We do show the purchased air travel. So, you know, if you fly out of PDX or SeaTac, those don't count as local emissions because the flying is not, you know, within the county. But this just provides some context on, you know, that emits a lot of greenhouse gases too, but it's not our focus for this work. We are focused on those green sources. Okay, and so we have more breakdowns in our report, but I was just going to highlight those two larger sources. All right, so the last key data set and set of definitions, if we go to the next slide, relate to these new requirements around environmental justice. So the Growth Management Act, they did add a bunch of new definitions related to environmental justice into the law. I've got the definitions for vulnerable populations and overburdened community up on the screen. And, you know, we've had to keep this in mind throughout our work because this is the first time anything like this has shown up in the Growth Management Act, right? So I'm really needing to make sure we use a lens to think about our more vulnerable community members as we do this work. And so if you go to the next slide, we did that in a few ways. One, we made sure we were engaging with more vulnerable community members. Two, we used an equity lens where we considered policies and, you know, who was being impacted, how can we reduce those impacts, and so forth. And then where we have data, we are looking at it too. So on the left side here, this is the environmental health disparities map. It combines socioeconomic and environmental data. The darker the purple, the more burdened a census tract is. So you can see, looking at a map of the county, where our more burdened census tracts are when you look at these cumulative health disparities. On the right is a map of some air quality data. Darker green means worse air quality. Fairly similar overlap, you know, where our more burdened communities are also where the air quality is worse. So again, just sort of a lens we needed to keep in mind as we were coming up with some policies, that this kind of information and data needed to be considered as well. Okay.
Are the cities taken out of this study? Because they're still part of Clark County. I know
they're
just gray.
Good question. So for the county's planning, we are only responsible for unincorporated Clark County. However, the cities also have to implement this law. So all the cities, we're all working in parallel. We all have the same deadline. All of the cities, except for Yackel and LaCenter, have to do both resilience and greenhouse gas reduction planning. So same requirements as the county. Yakult and LaCenter only have to do resilience planning because they're small enough. It's a different set of requirements for them. But that means every jurisdiction in the county right now is working on adding these climate elements into our comprehensive
plan. You're working in parallel, but are you coordinating at all with other cities?
Yeah, so there's some coordination. So in one area, I'm going to talk about this in a moment, we do need to come up with countywide planning policies. So we do need some overarching things that everyone's going to agree to across all jurisdictions. And then we did, we actually did share some of our consultants for the technical background work, but every jurisdiction is doing their own, you know, policy development and so forth and so on. But if you're tracking any of the other comp plan processes for any of the cities, you will be seeing similar, you know, similar types of things. And I guess the one other thing I'd add is, I think as you all probably know, you know, City of Vancouver did a bunch of climate work a few years ago. So they're a bit sort of ahead of the curve, whereas the rest of us were starting from scratch and doing our climate work. All right. So let's go to the next section. And I'm going to actually start to talk about what the heck is being proposed based on all of these new requirements and things like that. So we can go to the next slide. Okay. All right. So I think as you may know, in any comprehensive plan element, so if you look at a chapter in the county's comprehensive plan, there are two sets of policies. There are countywide planning policies, which the county and city councils all need to approve. And then there are the county 20-year planning policies, which just apply to the unincorporated county. So in the proposed policies that we have right now, there are 10 countywide planning policies that a working group of staff from various jurisdictions, we've worked together on them. So these are going to have to go to each city council and the county council. And these policies are mostly restating the legislation, you know, sort of committing that we will implement this legislation, or are around coordination and collaboration. How are we going to work together on our climate work in the future? So they're very logistical and sort of requirement based type policies. And then we have the 20-year planning policies, which this is our CAGS recommendation. So that group, that really diverse group that was using consensus to make some recommendations, these policies are what that group recommended. So I do have a link on this slide that will take you to the direct what happened when they voted on a whole bunch of policies at the end of their process. So that is linked here. But if you open it, you're going to see that there are 32 goals with 123 policies nested underneath them. And each goal or policy is either, you know, helping reduce greenhouse gas emissions, helping with resilience, or both. We found a lot of overlap, so we ended up just merging everything into a single list. And we broke things out into 7 general categories. So we have policies related to health and well-being, green jobs, ecological stewardship, transportation and land use, buildings and energy, waste management, and county governance. So if we go to the next slide. Okay, this is my attempt to put all the key topics on a single slide, but I apologize, it's kind of tiny and hard to read. But this, the idea is this is just to give you a flavor of what, you know, this is covering a lot of different topics. The guidance had us look across 11 sectors and, you know, we had to do all these requirements. So it covers a lot of ground. So we have several policies related to health and well-being. A lot of these have to do with equity, but also really focusing on our more vulnerable community members. How do we make sure people are safe? But also things like related to healthy food and making sure we can keep growing food as the climate changes. You know, housing as a resilience measure. You know, we need to make sure people have shelter, things like that. So a bunch of things like that in the health and well-being category. We have a green jobs category focused on, you know, making sure our workforce is ready, right? And how do we make sure we're really well trained and in various types of green jobs? Ecological stewardship, there's a lot of policies related to trees and county green spaces and things like forestry and protecting salmon, but also our water resources and stormwater and, you know, public education around those topics. Transportation and land use policies are relating to that key requirement around reducing vehicle miles traveled, but also how the county is going to reduce emissions from its own vehicles, how to support electric vehicles. How do we build a more resilient transportation system? And how do we make sure our development is more resilient? Building in energy policies, policies related to energy efficiency. How do we have, you know, more clean, renewable, diverse building energy options? Reducing the county's emissions from its own facilities. And then also promoting green building and sustainable building practices. Waste management, again, getting at how do we reduce emissions related to how we manage waste in the county, and then county governance policies around county's own operations and staffing to do this work. Most of the policies, we do have a draft new climate chapter are being proposed in there, but we are putting some of the policies in other places. So like the transportation policies just seem to fit better in our transportation chapter. So they're going to live there. So anyway, it's a bit of a mix of a lot in a new climate chapter, but some are going to show up elsewhere. And we've come up with a system to just flag policies wherever they are and say, oh, this is a climate policy too. Okay. Go to the next slide. All right. So I was going to highlight, so there's a lot of goals. I wanted to just highlight ones that I thought were maybe most relevant to you all. I am not, but I'm going to highlight six.
And you can skip the policies too.
Yeah. So I have a link to the policies, which we are right now, we are briefing the Planning Commission and Council where we are walking through that whole table. You are welcome to read it on your own time. I thought I'd just call your attention to the primary goals that I think overlap with you all's work. So 14.16 is the promoting energy efficient buildings, and there's a set of policies related to that. 14.17 is the promote a just approach to increasing clean, renewable, and diverse building energy options in unincorporated Clark County to achieve net zero greenhouse gas emissions. So a set of policies around there. I will just make a note, Initiative 2066, I imagine you all are familiar with, you know, appeared during our work, has had a court ruling on it, but is being appealed to the Supreme Court. So our set of policies, building and energy policies, we wrote them to be, we think, consistent with both House Bill 1181 and I-2066, but there's that initiative is still in flux because we're waiting on the Supreme Court to rule on it. So anyway, that's an added complication and complexity to this work. And then goal 14.19 is on promote green building and sustainable building practices. So a few policies under there. And if we go to the next slide, in the transportation and land use category, we have a goal to reduce vehicle trips and miles viewed through an equity lens within the county through changes to land use, transportation infrastructure, and commuting options and modes. There's a goal, this one's going to be in the transportation chapter, 5.8, on promote equitable adoption of electric vehicles to achieve greenhouse gas reduction target and improve air quality where it is worse. And then 14.15, encourage resilient development within the unincorporated urban growth area and away from areas that are prone to climate-related hazards such as flooding and wildfire. Okay, I'm almost done. So just to recap where we are in the process, we go to the next slide. I'm just going to re-show this timeline again. So we are in the process of reviewing these policy tables with the Planning Commission and County Council, but they are not holding hearings and voting on this until the very end of the comp plan process. So either late this year or early next. So I invite you all, if you want to comment on these, you are welcome as individuals or as a group to do so, but it's many months out. so you have lots of time to take a look and decide, you know, if you'd like to do that. So I think I'll pause there. Glad to answer questions. I know covers a lot of ground.
First of all, that's a lot of information to take in. I think all of us are sitting here going, how are they going to do this? What's it going to include? So well done. And I think there needs to be kudos given for everybody that's been part of this group. Does anybody have any questions for Jenna? Seeing none, I'm sure that something will come up along the way as we get further into this. Based on your schedule, looks like you're about 4/5 of the way through, but you still have a long ways to go. And am I to understand that Planning Commission and Council will be voting on this new chapter along with all of the other changes to all of the other chapters as well?
That is correct. So those are going to be very long hearings. So we encourage you to submit your comments in writing, you know, for sure, you know, but
right. It
is. This is part of a very large project. So any policy changes in any other chapter, it's all part of the same hearing.
Gotcha.
And I will say, you know, we have wrapped up our advisory group work. We now have this draft set of policies. So as staff, we're basically now just making sure everyone knows what's in it. So our sort of active work is done. But now there's just this big lag time until it's going to get voted on. So plenty of time for looking at it, asking questions, you know, thinking about what you might want to say.
But there's still time for it to be massaged and you know, maybe tweaked a little bit, or are you running with what you've got now? That's it.
I think any sort of additional comments we will bring to the Planning Commission and Council for them to consider. So okay. It doesn't mean no changes can
gotcha.
Be made, but we have our advisory group's recommendation, which is what.
Now it's up to the policymakers to.
Right. So that's okay. Sort of going to move forward, but they can consider additional.
All right. Feedback. Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
So just one, I guess, observation or comment.
Yeah.
One, a lot of information in here. A lot of work has gone into it. Some pretty lofty goals here.
Yeah.
One thing I always see with these is, was a cost-benefit analysis of policies considered? Because you see, sometimes you see minimal environmental gains, but huge costs. And then when you look at balancing competing interests and then impacts on homelessness and affordable housing, so there's multiple elements in the comp plan. So if one is looking at, you know, you have to balance those. Mm-hmm. So if we're looking at trying to do what we can with the resources we have, what I've seen before with some of these regulations is they don't care about the cost, and that's not really considered. It's just preservation of the resource or meeting this particular goal. But if it's done in a vacuum, it has a lot of unintended consequences. It throws things out of balance. It impacts homelessness. It impacts, you know, it could actually have negative impacts to the environment unknowingly. And housing affordability. So you look at examples like in our temperate climate, you know, what is the most cost-effective, like just window, okay, or, you know, that you're putting in your home. At a certain point, you hit a point of diminishing returns. Can you do better? You could always do better. Mm-hmm. But there's that kind of balance of when it hits that peak where, okay, is this where we want to spend our resources, or now do we want to look at hitting where we're getting the most for most bang for our buck, and then focusing our resources on other things. So I guess that's kind of just my observation, and I'm curious how that went through the committee, and is it looking at those competing interests?
Yeah. So I'll respond. I also saw Noelle trying to raise her hand in the back. So whenever you all want to take public comment, I think you all can manage that. But anyway, I can start and then you all can manage that. So we did do some assessment it's actually on our Planning Commission's webpage and their materials for the meeting we have tonight with them. Late last summer with some draft policies, we did assess several criteria, cost being one of them, you know, feasibility, does the county have authority to do this? So across several different criteria, pretty high level analysis. So these are like 10,000 foot goals, right? They are not super specific. So you can't do super specific analysis on them. So we did do some assessment of that. And I think Noelle can speak to this, but my perception of the CAG is that those different interests were very well represented. Those were very, that group did not, you know, not everyone was on the same page, right? In that group, we had very spirited discussions. So I do think they, you know, tried to find balance, right? And House Bill 1181 is a requirement. So there's certain parts of this we have to do, even if we don't know how, right? And those details we're going to have to work on down the road. Just because it gets adopted to the comp plan policy, it doesn't immediately make something happen, right? It's then our job to then figure out how to implement those policies. So there's sort of a few different angles there.
Noelle?
Sure. I would totally agree with Jenna. There was a broad array of positions presented, a lot of vigorous debate ongoing. And I would say that it's going to be really important for each of you, and this is a big ask, is to read through all the policies. I think as you do, you're going to see that the work, like Jenna said, putting a cost benefit to some of the policies is going to be really difficult at this point because it is a baseline. So I know that's a big ask to have you read through them. I, as part of the CAG, feel really confident pushing forward what we came up with. And I think it meets the requirement of HB 1181.
Yeah.
And I think it also does give enough flexibility for the county, the industry, to do what they need to do. So.
Thank you both. Anything else from anybody? Awesome. So will we be seeing you again as things move forward, or is this pretty much your presentation? How's this gonna? It's now up to everybody else. And
so I think if you all want me to come back, I'm happy to, but our draft policies are out there now. So the links in your materials will take you there. So I think it sort of depends if you want to talk in.
Sure. And I think that what Jose's done on past comp plan updates is that once you get through planning commission and council, maybe come back and give us a brief update as far as what any changes, were proposed. What was the temperature of the commission and council? Anything they wanted you to look at, anything they wanted you to remove or anything like that, just so that we have a full understanding of is this moving forward verbatim, or is there going to be a little bit of tweaking taking place following discussions with the policymakers?
All right. Sounds good.
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it. All right. Moving on, Brent, you're up. Sorry, I read ahead a little bit. Gosh, 3 minutes early. I heard that actually.
All right. Good afternoon. So I'm here today to talk about our concurrent review process. This is still very much a pilot sort of draft, learn as we go. We don't have anything formalized in terms of code. This is really our first attempt at starting to write down some I provided is really taken from a draft of an internal procedure document that we're trying to put together. It is draft. I noticed looking at today, there's some typos. I'll try to get those clarified and hopefully get a clean copy back to Deeb for the minutes. But just to reiterate, I think what I said last month, we've actually only done two concurrent reviews. We have a third one that we have approved for concurrent review that has not come in yet. So we don't really have a whole lot of experience to work with. And we have, since completing those two projects, we did come together as staff. We had a meeting with city staff to talk about their process and sort of compare notes, found out that a lot of the things that we are seeing as potential challenges are things that they're also seeing as challenges. There really wasn't a whole lot of difference between the two of us on that. So I'll just walk through this handout that was provided to you a couple days ago. So the first thing that we're trying to figure out is how we want to allow people to request concurrent review, because we do envision, at least for the time being, that it's still going to be subject to management approval. And so what we've come up with so far is that you can either include it in your pre-application conference that you're requesting it, so it can be addressed in the pre-app report. Or if you determine subsequent to pre-app that you would like to bring a project to us for concurrent review, we are going to ask you to apply for a pre-app waiver. And we can use that process to route the information and get a decision from management as to whether or not we can support the concurrent review.
I didn't track that. You can ask for it when you submit your pre-app, or
subsequent to your pre-app, if you decide you want to move forward with concurrent review, you can apply for a pre-app waiver to add, essentially
ask for it. But then we still have to go through a pre-app.
Not if you've already been through a pre-app.
Oh, okay. I'm with you. So this would be following your pre-app if you decide at that point in time.
Correct. Or if you have a project that doesn't require a pre-app, the pre-app waiver would still be the process.
Like on a type one.
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks.
Yeah. Along with that, we are a little bit concerned about the significant time lag between when we've decided concurrent review is appropriate and a project actually comes in the door. So at this point, we're looking at a 60-day window. We may find with some projects that's not long enough, particularly if you're asking it pre-app. I do recognize that. Along with that, though, I think if we're in communication, you're coming up on 60 days, reach out, you know, hey, we're still working on this. We still intend to do concurrent review. We're not, you know, making any significant changes from what we've showed you before. We'd need another 60 days or whatever. We're definitely open to that.
Yeah, and the only reason why I'm glad you hear that, because sometimes it takes, depending on the size of the project, it could take 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks to just do the final engineering design to get something submitted. I mean, most of the planning stuff is already done in advance of that, but it's the detail on the detailing out ADA ramps and stuff like that. That's the long.
Yeah, and I think one thing I'll probably add to this when we get to the point of putting it out for applicants to use as a reference is, you know, that if you know you're going to need more time when you submit your request, that you could include that in your request.
Yeah, alongside of that, the architectural plan development often takes, there's a lot of that programming phase and determining what the needs are with the project. They're taking feedback that they get from the pre-op. And so to develop that building plan, and then it impacts your site plan layout, you know, and then to go through and do your final engineering development design, 60 days is, you know, I don't know if really any of the projects we've been involved with would be able to turn around in that time frame.
Okay, well, I think, you know, again, as we go and we learn more, I also anticipate that, you know, hopefully down the road we'll be being able to do this with more complex projects, and then, you know, those time considerations are likely to become more important. But again, you know, if you don't want to jump in fully when you submit your pre-app, and, you know, you get the feedback you need, you can start working through that, you know, then you can come in with a pre-app waiver request to work, you know, because you may need to do more due diligence to see if you can actually do it concurrently or not. But again, we're willing to work with that time frame. We just don't want it to be open-ended, and, you know, be like 8 months later we're seeing plans like, oh, did we approve this for concurrent review? So that's really what we're trying to get at. So there's a list of additional application types and or complicating factors here that we're, at least at this point, we're not likely to support a concurrent review if these elements are part of your proposal. You know, that doesn't mean there might be cases where we can agree that it's appropriate, but.
So did the two pilot projects that you reviewed not have any road modifications associated with them?
So they were part of the same industrial subdivision, and they had completed the subdivision process. And so we did concurrent review on the individual site plans for the different phases of it.
Okay. You know where I'm going with that, right?
Right. But when we start talking about timelines and trying to deal with final engineering plans, and you've got this road mod that's make or break for whether or not your project is feasible, you know, you really need to figure that out before you want to start doing final engineering. And, you know, if there may be cases where you can potentially do your road mod, do a road mod as a standalone in advance, or we can condition the road mod as part of the land use approval. But then again, you're going to have to come back and revise your plans. So that's why we included it, because it does create those complications. In terms of the process, when you are submitting for a concurrent review, you'll be applying for your ENG if it's a site plan, your FLR, and your PSR at the same time. But in terms of our internal procedure, we want to do all the intake through LMS and through the planner. So you'll essentially be submitting all of your documents for the first time in LMS under your land use application. And then both development engineering and land use will do their counter complete process. Once it's counter complete, then land use will begin the fully complete process. Both submittals have to, neither submittal is going to be fully complete until both submittals are fully complete. So you may get everything in engineering that you need for them, but we're still working on some land use or vice versa. So once they're fully complete, then development engineering will open up project docs for you to do your plan submittal for the review. So you'll have your engineering plans and your final site plan in project docs for that review process. And then you'll have your those documents with all your other land use documents in LMS in the land use process. So, you know, one of the challenges is we want to make sure that we don't end up with different versions of documents. When revisions are coming in up through early issues, at least we want to make sure that they're still all going through the planner. So we have one clearinghouse for those documents. The next step in our process, once you're fully complete, is early issues. And the process is structured so that you're getting your first engineering plan review concurrently with your early issues. So that means that you, as part of your concurrent application, you're essentially agreeing to potentially delay your first review comments because we may not get early issues done within that 21 days. We generally are doing those at 30 days with the rest of our process. Once you have your early issues, we also would ask that when you resubmit, that you're resubmitting everything essentially at the same time. It's not coming in piecemeal.
Like the entire application? Because I know that that's how we do it with fully complete, meaning if there's something missing.
Whatever you're submitting in response, that you're not submitting changes to your engineering plans in project docs and then at a different time submitting land use, it's all coming in as a package. So that everybody that's doing reviews knows that everything's in and everything's ready to move forward. Once we're past early issues, if everything is resolved from a land use side, essentially, there's really no more need for connection of the two review processes other than development engineering can't issue final approval of plans or a final site plan until the land use decision is issued, right? But if there are additional revisions after that point, whether they're initiated by staff or by the applicant, there is a risk, depending on the nature of those revisions and what complications those might bring into the process, that we could decide to decouple the reviews. And if we did that, essentially, your engineering and final review process would essentially have to go on hold until the land use was done.
Brent, just as clarification, you said that the first review of the engineering plans would come through at early issues, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Right. So you have your first red lines on your plans and your early issues at the same time. All right. Let's see. I think, you know, that's mostly it. And so then in terms of the, you know, getting your final plans approved, if everything's gone smoothly, once the land use decision is issued, if your engineering plans have essentially been determined to be ready for Mylar or for final approval, you would get that Mylar call after the land use decision is issued. So that's really it in a nutshell.
Do you think that this will be able to be done still within 78 days after FC?
That's the intent. Right. Yeah, that we're not adding any additional time, you know, same process for holds. Mm-hmm. And we just need to make sure that if the land use is going on hold, that engineering knows that the engineering is also going on hold.
Okay.
You know, and at some point that might be a little bit out of cycle after we get past early issues. And if that starts to occur, we'll have to figure out how to re-coordinate that if we need to.
How about how are you handling the applicant's response to engineering red lines vis-a-vis maintaining the review process? Are you stopping the county's clock when those red lines are returned to the applicant?
Well, that's why we're doing the first review with early issues,
mm-hmm.
right? If you need to stop the clock to address all of those things, including your red lines, mm-hmm. then you would let us know that you can't get it done within the 2 weeks.
Okay, so you're providing 2 weeks as part of early issues.
Right.
In order to also address first round red lines.
Correct.
Within the 78-day timeline.
Correct. And so if you need more time, you ask for it, it goes on hold.
Yep.
And we apply our policies about additional days for review, et cetera, et cetera, the same as we would any other way.
Okay.
After early issues,
mm-hmm.
You know, if you're in your second review, presumably by then, anything that you're changing in red lines shouldn't be affecting your land use decision as long as all the early issues have been addressed.
Mm.
And maybe we're contemplating conditions, and there may be some, I can envision we may have some cases where you get some conditions in your land use decision that you've already addressed in engineering because the planner's not connecting those dots.
Uh-huh.
You know, which I don't see as a big concern as long, you know, because they can still be checked off that they're already addressed. But, you know, as an applicant, you may want to see some of those things cleaned up and not have those conditions if they've already been addressed. So we can work through that.
Okay.
As we go.
That's great. Cause we've experienced with the city of Vancouver's process. We've had final engineering plans approved before we've had land use approved. I mean, they're just sitting there waiting to be released once land use is approved. I think we're all very encouraged by this and look forward to, you know, all of us at some point in time going through at least a smaller project on it to see how it works for us.
You know, I think the challenge for us is for applicants that maybe not less detail oriented or you know, we know that some applicants are more likely to struggle with this process than others. And those are the ones that unfortunately are going to, you know, push us towards being more hesitant to take certain kinds of applications. But, you know, we'll see how it goes.
Okay.
And I don't envision at this point, you know, bringing code forward, for this, unless we run into a situation where procedurally we need to.
And I don't think the city has theirs in code either. I think it's all policy. So I'm pretty sure theirs isn't in code.
Yeah.
They just have their standard land use and engineering reviews in code, and that the streamlined review process is just a policy. So I don't know as if that's absolutely necessary, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, we may find that we may need to put some minimal language in there that makes it clear that this is allowed and that it may change certain elements of timelines. And
Brent, the city also allows us to do it with a type one site plan as long as you waive the timeline, which overall still leads to a shorter approval period. So it might be something that you also consider.
Sounds like we can already do it with the type one.
Well, it's
but
here it specifically states.
Yeah, I think too. With the timeline, I think we would need that waiver of the.
We would. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good call.
But I honestly see that as an advantage because you know, that helps get all those details out on the table and should make the land use portion of it much simpler.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess any feedback on the couple that have gone all the way through, does it lead to less staff hours in the review by combining that preliminary review with the final?
I would say it's a mixed bag.
Okay.
We've had two projects. One was challenging and one was pretty straightforward and went through. I mean, they were very similar in, you know, from a, I guess, high level perspective. It's just one of them, the process took longer, more complicated, more revisions. And quite frankly, I think that probably generated more work for staff. I'm trying to keep it coordinated.
I do have one thing, and I think this all looks great, great goals. But I think more of an elephant in the room, I think some other processes are probably going to be highlighted when you try to do this. So things like, you know, we've talked about it before, things that are actively on our work plan, like the road mod, staffing and resources. I think this is great. The process is great. But there's some other things at the county we need to kind of get through as a group and come to a solution there. Because I think if we try to run through a process like this where we're trying to speed things up, that's going to be really apparent. And it could take resources away from other things. So I think this is great. You know, but we have to continue on some of our other work, like, you know, the road mod we talked about, I think, last time. Melanie Davis had a presentation. Just kind of that the culture of yes. Trying to come up with a solution instead of, nope, here's why I can't do it. And, you know, it's frustrating because most of the time, I know that when we ask for something like a you know, road mod variance, there's a good reason for it. We're not asking for things that we think shouldn't be approved. We usually tell our clients, nope, don't go there. It's not going to get approved. It's a waste of your time, waste of our effort. We don't want to argue for it. We pretty much only submit things that we think have a strong basis for support and should be approved. I know that's not always the case, but those are situations I think we're dealing with as a development community. Also, I know staffing and resources. In April, we're gonna miss you. And it's keeping, you know, we've been doing, I don't know, we have quite a bit of experience in the room, and I mean, I've been working in the field and went through so many different staff people, and it seems like someone has a different opinion. And right when we get someone like that really starts getting it, they're gone, and it's frustrating. And I think one thing that this board can do is kind of we have a good basis of institutional knowledge. We can, I mean, most of us have been on committees for the codes that we're interpreting now. And when you look at it, we know exactly what the situation was and why this came up, why the code says what it does. It's not always just in the language. There's the why it was put in place.
Some of us were involved with the code writing to begin with.
Right. Yeah. So those are the things. It's more of just a bigger picture item, and this is great.
We'll see how
great
it job plays out.
Yeah, but we also need to look at some of these other pieces, and I'd like to get some of those on our list, kind of moving forward. We looked at our work plan, yeah. And a few of them was, you know, back to the road mod thing. I don't know what we can do on staffing and resources, how we could help, but if there's something we can do to help, maybe help work with staff to help train, because we do have that information and. You know, work closely together. Again, it's that culture of collaboration.
Yep.
Instead, it should never be us versus them. It should be, here's the goal. Here's what we're trying to get to. How do we get there?
Right.
And that's what I think we really need to work towards. So, those are kind of my personal goals for this committee over the next year.
Cool.
And this is a great step. So, just wanted to bring that up.
All right. We are 4 minutes over. We'll give anybody from the public a chance, 30 seconds to say what they want to say. Anybody here? Seeing none. Anybody online? Seeing none. We are adjourned. Thank you.